And it makes me, talking about the coal and the different, like the link between plants and geology, and there's also, like, there are a lot of mines here, And so how does that, I mean, have the mines affected these rare plants that,
There's a federal law out there called the Endangered Species Act. It was enacted and amended in 1973. So plants that are considered either they go in, like in a hierarchy, like endangered being the most critical, and then the next group immediately below that is the threatened status. This is all federal listing. And then below the threatened status is what we would call candidate species. There's like C1, C2, C3, and these are all plants that are in the process of being upgraded to either threatened or endangered. So that's the federal kind of classification. And then there's some for each, like the New Mexico. They have their own list, which they call like list one, list two, list three, and these are like endangered, threatened, sensitive. And then the Navajo tribe has their own list called like group one, group two, group three, group four, and then their sensitive list again. And then again, these are like endangered, threatened, and all that. It's kind of based on the categorization that the federal government has in place. And like here in the community of Shiprock, there's a plant called Sclerocactus Mesa Verde, or the Mesa Verde cactus, which is federally listed as endangered. There's a lot of different community development projects that were proposed, like there was like a 450 acre housing tract development that was proposed. There's a 200 acre rodeo ground that was proposed. There's a casino area that was proposed, and so all these different areas that were proposed pretty much had Mesa Verde cactus that grew within these proposed boundaries, proposed site areas. And based on the numbers that they found them, and just because they were federally listed, they couldn't go in there and take any of them out or alter its habitat in any way. So that's one example of how the designation of that plant has caused Shiprock to, really hinder its economic growth. It's the growth for the town itself. And then another example is like with the mining industry. The mines currently sitting in an area where there's a lot of like badlands, really barren badlands, and there's some plants in there that are sensitive, but they're not really quite listed as federally endangered or threatened. So that kind of gives the mine some leeway where they can, like maybe avoid certain areas or mitigate for certain regions that they're going to mine out. And then with these mitigation measures, they might provide money like to the Navajo Heritage Program, where they can use that money to like study other rare plants or study like mammals and stuff like that. So it's a, but they are right in an area where there's like several plants that should be listed as either threatened or endangered, and they're still mining in there. But we found that some of the populations that occur there are more extensive beyond the mine lease than originally thought. So that's one of the reasons why I think they let it, the allowed them to go ahead and continue to mine in there. But a lot of these mine leases were like from like the 60s, 50s, and 60s, so it predates the Endangered Species Act. So that's what they also use legally to say, all right, we can legally mine in here because our lease predates the Endangered Species Act. So that's one way of them, for them to get around that as well.
Wow, that's even though it's still endangered today, I mean.
Yeah, like this one project that out here, the power line project here. There's this Mesa Verde cactus that grows on the power line within the corridor. And right now, I think they're in negotiating or mitigating measures with the Navajo tribe, the Tribal Heritage Program. But there's really actually no teeth to the Endangered Species Act, because the power line was put in like in the 60s, and it predates the Endangered Species Act. So it kind of there's kind of like a it's kind of like in legal limbo right now. And if you go further into the San Juan Basin, it's really heavily impacted by the oil and gas industry. Like the San Juan Basin, there's probably at least my last estimation was probably 60,000 wells out there, 60 to 70,000 wells. And think about that. That's, you know, that's when you take a look, when you put that on a map, it looks like you just spilled like a whole shaker full of pepper, like on a white piece of map for San Juan County, you know. And that's what it would look like, you know, with all those wells out there. And within these well sites, there's a lot of what I would call fragmentation of habitat, not only for plants, but for wildlife. You know, there's a lot of, like around the Navajo Dam area, going east of the Navajo Dam area, up into Carson National Forest. I remember when I was a kid, like in the late 60s, early 70s, that place is really, really, really neat, really clean. I mean, all the roads back there were just like two-track roads. And right now, there's not a place where there's like, I mean, the whole place is just totally full of oil wells now. Pipelines and all these roads are really well-maintained, wide, and they're like all-weather roads. So, and then I've noticed that the quality of the mule deer that was there also really went down. Like the numbers also went down as well, because just the constant fragmentation of their habitat, and then they pull in each one of these well sites also require like maybe five well sites might require like a compressor station, where you get these compressor stations that are really loud as well, and that kind of drives off the wildlife as well. So in that area, you know, it's not only the plants, but you know, it's all those just the way they're breaking up the land. And when you do that, it just provides easy access, like provides habitat for like weeds, like plants that we consider like noxious weeds. Mm-hmm. And like thistles, Russian thistles, Russian knapweed, spotted knapweed, and you get like a knotty thistle and bull thistles that, you know, totally cover these pipeline right-of-ways and pipeline settings, I mean, well pad settings. And in the past, well, they're getting better about it now. You know, the oil and gas industry, they're getting a lot better at kind of reclaiming some of the areas that they've already like disturbed. And in them regions, they tend to do a little bit of reclamation, but it's not really that. They don't really. In some areas, it's really hard for them to really do a really good job because, you know, they probably didn't save the topsoil and stuff like that. You know, they might just have barren clay that they just try to throw seeds on and try to make something grow, but sometimes it doesn't really work for them. So they're kind of behind in their reclamation efforts, but it's getting a little bit better in the oil and gas industry. In the mining industry, it's really good. I think it's not too bad in terms of the reclamation. Mm-hmm. Because I used to work as a summer student for 4 years with BHP. Here, worked at three different mine sites, and we're doing like rangeland assessments with them. And before they go into an area, before they mine out an area, they do a complete inventory, biologic inventory of everything that's there, all the plant community types, what's there, what amount, what percent cover, and stuff like that. So they use that as a baseline data. Where after they destroy, like after they mine out a certain area, they reclaim it and then they replant it. They'll use that as a data and say, all right, this is what was there before, and this is what is here now. And oftentimes, you know, they improve on the amount of cover and also the type of vegetation that's there. So, you know, it's just in terms of acreage of land disturbance, I think that's the only thing that's really kind of detrimental. And then with the power plant, that's a whole new issue there. There's a lot of controversy about that going on right now, especially with the new proposed Desert Rock plant. Mm-hmm. If that's going to go through, then we're going to have three power plants here in the San Juan Basin. But I don't know. It's the way I see it, I think it's time for to maybe decommission like maybe one of those power plants, like the Four Corners power plant, the APS, Arizona Public Service. Because that was first built like in the 1960s, and I think like 1960. So most power plants, they have a lifespan of maybe 45 to 60 years before they stop becoming running efficiently. So I think it's nearing its end, its life cycle, where they need to probably get rid of that one and put on this new one here. But it's a With the Navajo tribe, I think it's a done deal with the Navajo tribe, you know, because of the financial setting that they're in right now. They're trying to look for new financial sources to bring into their tribal budget. But with the local people, the local grassroots people, and a lot of the communities that surround the proposed area, you know, there's a number that are speaking out against it, and they're also, you know, they oppose the project. And mainly because of health concerns, like health problems, dealing with asthma and bronchitis and emphysema and stuff like that, and you know, the breathing problems related to all those particles in the air. And then also, to some extent, a lot of people don't want any more mining in that region, because some of the people that live down in that area, some of the grassroots people that I've talked to that live in the area, they say that that's a kind of like a secret site in that region right across the wash from there. That's a lot of the medicine people know, and they know this area too, because they know that that's a natural pathway for large winds coming through there, funnel clouds, and there's even a reporting of a small touchdown of a funnel cloud, like a minor tornado that touched down a couple of years back. So in that region, they have a small spring there right on the Hogback, and they usually offer, like the medicine people, they usually offer like a small offering there to appease the wind gods, to kind of calm down the winds there. So that's one of the reasons why they don't want anything being built in that region as well. And then in terms of natural resources like raptors in that region, from personal experience, I think it's probably one of the best frugious hawk habitats in the whole United States area. I think there's probably at least maybe 5-6 different breeding pairs in there. And if you go further north, there's some more nesting sites in there. So, you know, just based on the raptor use in that area too, I think it's not really a good idea to maybe put up that plant there. But, you know, I think people should have started long ago, many years ago, before they really initiated the project. You know, they should have spoken out against it and say no, you know, not to have it there. I think right now it's gone into the process where it's went through the process so long, and now it's really hard for them to turn back and, you know, just discard a project that big. Because a lot of money has already been used. Not only the tribe, you know, the tribe probably has put in at least 15 to 20 million on it already. And then other investors like South Global and stuff like that. So I don't know what's going to happen to that. More than likely, I think it's going to be a done deal. But the people that that use that area, the grassroots people, the grazing right, the grazing area users, they think that once they defeat the power plants, and the power plant, they decide not to build it there. That's not the end of the story though, because BHP has a lease that extends all the way down to Burnham, and they're going to mine out in an area probably 8 miles by a mile and a half to 2 miles wide again. Right now, they're right at the southern end of their lease, and the northern end of their lease is where the power plant site is going to be at. So if they decide not to build a plant, all BHP has to do is just to extend their train tracks across the wash another few miles, and they'll continue mining that way. So that's one thing that nobody's looking at right now. Let me take a break.
Okay. Yeah. Is there anything that you see that that shows you the connection between land and culture?
Yeah, almost on a daily basis.
Or in any, you know, it might be seasonal, it might be daily, it might be just.
Yeah, it's well. With Navajos, we think about land on a daily basis. We think, I think about plants and stuff like that on a daily basis. Like with plants, you know, we consider them plant people. They're dynamic, they're on the move, and they're, you know, you talk to them and stuff like that. So, I think it's like we see it in our artwork, we see it in our sand paintings. Even this, the teachings, the Navajo teachings, it's all from the land. Like, man, women were developed from corn. Like, man was developed from white corn, women was developed from yellow corn. And that's how our creation story starts off, you know, we're from the dirt, you know, from the ground. And, well, like, with Navajos, we consider, like, the ground, like, we call it, like, we pray in the morning, whenever, you know, it's not like, only specified, like, on Sundays or, like, on certain times, any time of the day, you make offerings, like, to the earth, you know, like, you call it your mother earth, and you make reference to the sky, which would be, like, your father or your, you know, the heavens, and then you realize that there's an interface between the heaven and the ground, and there's, like, there's something going on there, you know, and you're involved in that, you're part of that big old circle, you know, that's why I put everything into perspective, like birds, trees, you know, the mammals. We're all related. We're all interconnected. You take out one out of the system, that's gonna hurt something else. And that's the way I see it every day. It's like you think about it, and like these stories that they tell you about. They'll say that in the past, you know, the Earth Service Bureau, the Navajos, we used to be able to communicate with birds. We used to be able to talk to like all kinds of livestock, all kinds of animals, all kinds of insects, and we talked to the wind, we talked to the elements, and somehow we lost that. You know, we don't really do that anymore. But I still see that. You know, I see that everywhere I drive. I see these landforms have a specific meaning to all of us. There's specific tales that are associated with each landform, and then you see it in the, like, sand paintings that we have. You see these four sacred plants on a lot of our paintings. You know, there's a lot of, like, the symbolism of the four sacred plants that come on out. You have symbolisms of the emergence hole where the Navajos first came out of there, from the ground, you know, from the lower world onto this world. And then a lot of our sand paintings, they have, like, animals that are also depicted either as guardians or, like, specific meanings to that particular painting. So we have not only our artwork, but also, like, our teachings. And then even just being down at the market, you know, you see that really close association. You still see people down there selling their wares, like they sell their herbal medicine, they sell their tobaccos, they sell their, like, all these different herbal plants that they sell for different specific uses. And you find all these people with different stands, you know, they'll have, like, mutton that they produce off their own livestock, and then they'll have, like, corn that they grow themselves, and they'll incorporate that into their food where they can sell it to people. They'll have, like, steamed corn and, like, nail down bread. And so, you know, you see it every day. It's a connection every day. And with people that live in the city, I think they're more caught up with the city life and how they survive and how, you know, how they can compete with other people. But here, you know, it's more relaxed, more open. You have time to enjoy the land. You enjoy the sunsets, and you work the land either by farming, by ranching, by livestock raising, you know, by harvesting seeds, and then also by you know just going hunting and stuff like that. You know, that's the way to harvest the land and live off the land. So I think a lot of people that live out here in the Southwest or the West, you know, they're not only like the Navajos, but Anglo societies that live out here, the Hispanics that live out here, they're really closely tied in with the landscape.
And if you could introduce yourself, because I forgot to have you.
my name is Arnold Clifford. I live in Baclavito, New Mexico, which is about 18 miles west of Shiprock, right south of the Four Corners, along the Carrizo Mountain Range. And my community is, we're at the base of the Carrizo Mountains, where, you know, like my sheep corral, and maybe a couple hundred feet west of my sheep corral is the Arizona line, but I'm in New Mexico. And we're, you know, we use both Arizona and New Mexico. My clan is I'm Ozeta Chini, which is my maternal clan. And then my paternal clan is the, I'm born for the Topai, which is near the waterside clan. And then my grandfathers are the Salt clan, or Ashin. And then my, that's my maternal grandfather. My paternal grandfather is a just not Ginny, which means a Black Street Mountain. And then, like my clan, Ozeta Chitney, there's not too many of us around. There's only a few hundred, maybe about 1,000 that live in the Shibrock, Baklavato, and just south of the immediate Shibrock area. Our clan was probably started like in the 1600s when a young Hopi maiden from Arabi was stolen from Canyon de Shea, and she was stolen by some Navajos, and they brought her over the mountain, and she was raised by the Tchachitnis, which is a specific clan. And so when she started her family, all her offspring, they were members of that clan, so it was a new clan system that started. And so there's the Arabi branch of the Ozay Tchachitni is what we are. And then for a long time, I was trying to figure out what Ozay meant as well. And I found out from an elderly lady from that same region, from Arabi and from Big Mountain area, she told me that Ozay meant killers. You know, they meant like hands that kill killers. I guess the people of Arabi, way back in the 1600s, there were some missionaries that went through there, and you know, there was conflict, and next thing you know, the missionaries got killed, and that's how that village got its name, Ozay. It means a village of killers. So that's how I see. Even in our clan teaching, there's a lot of teachings in it. You know, there's a lot of your clan system actually determines what kind of person that you're gonna be. Like with our, like if you took a, like my personality, all my traits, and then you compare them with the clan traits, and it's gonna match up really well. It's like almost like astrology. Mm. So you know, like me studying plants and all this stuff, it's all because of, you know, not only my clan system, but I'm probably like a 8th, 10th generation botanist, ethnobotanist. So I come from a long line of people that work with plants, and like my grandmother, her mom, and then like her paternal grandfather and stuff like that, you know. Mm. Yeah. And but all my studies, you know, all my studies that I'm doing, it's all self-funded. I don't get no grants or nothing. And you know, if I'm not around at home, then my parents, my dad, or my mom, you know, they'll take over some of the chores for me, that my chores. So I'm really grateful for them to, you know, for being there to help me out like that as well. You know, so I can pursue the studies that I'm pursuing.
Thank you.
Viga.